This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us today. HBO will be premiering a new film All the Way about President Johnson next weekend, so we thought we'd play some interviews about LBJ. We begin with presidential historian and Princeton University professor Julian Zelizer. He chronicled Johnson's travails in passing the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, as well as his Great Society programs in his 2015 book, The Fierce Urgency of Now. The book also discusses the lasting legacy of Medicaid and Social Security. Let's take a listen. I do want to play just a clip from a speech that Johnson delivered. This is titled The American Promise. It's to a joint session of Congress, March 15th, 1965, where he is urging Congress to pass the Voting Rights Act. Let's listen.
The command of the Constitution is plain. There is no moral issue. It is wrong, deadly wrong, to deny any of your fellow Americans the right to vote in this country. There is no issue of states' rights or national rights. There is only the struggle for human rights.
Julian, how long had President Johnson been in favor of voting rights?
He had been in favor of voting rights for many years. In 1957, he helps pass a bill that deals with voting rights very mildly. It's a watered-down bill. Johnson had been a Southerner who was very liberal. He saw himself as a New Dealer. And he had gradually come around to the idea that the arguments of the civil rights movement on segregation and on voting rights were correct. The movement helped change him, as did his own experience in Texas. And by the early 1960s, I think from when he's vice president already, Johnson's really coming along on this issue. By the time he is president in November 63, I think voting rights is something he believes in. He doesn't have any problem with the idea that the federal government should protect this right for African Americans. So his transformation is pretty complete by the time he enters the White House.
But you also say, and this perhaps is about a time and a place, is that privately he held what could be described as racist beliefs about African Americans being intellectually and physically inferior to whites, and then at the same time being this proponent for civil rights or for equal rights.
That's absolutely true, and he remains kind of schizophrenic that way. After the Watts riots in the summer of 1965, as he's talking through what to do, on the one hand, he'll condemn the rioters as irresponsible children who don't appreciate what he's done for them, really kind of horrendous language. But on the other hand, he'll have very candid conversations with people like the CIA director saying, you know, if we don't give people homes, if we don't end unemployment, if we don't give them good education and a chance, it's understandable why they're so angry and why in the inner city there's such fury. So he always had both sides of him. But overall, I think even with that kind of language and attitude, he had come along in favor of the idea that the federal government would offer these protections.
You describe Lyndon Johnson as a real New Dealer, and we should remember how, you know, this when he was president and the fact that he was alive during the New Deal and influenced very much by FDR's view of government.
Absolutely. He really came of age during the 1930s. He went to Washington in 1931 to work in his assistant for a guy named Congressman Richard Kleeberg, where he really learned about Washington. He was appointed the head of the National Youth Administration in Texas, where he goes back and is working for this New Deal program. But he really came to believe that the federal government was good. It was a basic argument of liberalism during this period, and it was something that he never lost. There were areas he was more conservative than other Democrats, like with unions. But overall, on most policies, the New Deal is what framed his mindset about politics. And he always very much wanted to expand, as president, what FDR had done.
And it seems he really hated being vice president of the United States and didn't have a lot of regard for President Kennedy.
He really didn't. He didn't like Kennedy. He thought he should be in the White House. He didn't like, most importantly, being on the sidelines. Kennedy didn't use him. They were scared to let him do too much work because they feared that he'd be too powerful and that he couldn't control himself. And ultimately, he felt that Kennedy didn't know what he was doing with Congress and that they weren't using Johnson effectively. It was a period of great frustration. Many people say the time of Kennedy's death, Johnson was really at the worst moment in his career, feeling very forlorn and frustrated with his role.
But you also say there's a kind of mythology that has grown up around Lyndon Johnson, that he was this all-powerful president who could sort of hector people in Congress to signing on to his legislation. And you're saying that really isn't an apt description of President Johnson.
Not at all. I, for many years, Johnson was hated as the guy, as the president who got us into Vietnam. But in the recent years, there's been this revival and almost a myth about Lyndon Johnson, that he was a legislative political magician who could do what no one else could do. The famous image of him is the treatment, where he would physically hover over members of Congress or activists and seduce them, cajole them, bully them into doing what he wanted. But that places way too much emphasis on him and less on the world in which he was president and the circumstances, the moment that really allowed him to move forward with all his bills. I think we now think too much of, you know, what were the tricks that Lyndon Johnson used rather than what was the Congress that he was facing.
I've always enjoyed hearing those conversations, taped conversations of President Johnson calling people up and sort of seducing them, flirting with them, pressuring them. I mean, it's an extraordinary personality and I guess use of presidential power that he had.
It was. I mean, what's remarkable, some of that works. But if you follow what happens after those conversations, often he doesn't get what he wants from them. Lyndon Johnson was trying to tell everyone around him, I don't have all the power everyone thinks I do. And he was sick of people constantly saying all the things he can do to turn a member of Congress, because he, more than anyone else, was aware of the limits of his power. And one of the reasons he moved so fast in 1965 with bills is he is aware, as a member of Congress for a long time, that eventually the good times are going to end, and they're going to end pretty quickly. So he never believed in the Johnson myth, and that was what pretty remarkable to me.
But why do you think this Johnson myth has been so enduring?
I think part of it is, you know, at least in the past few decades, we live in an era where Washington seems broken, where not a lot is getting done. So we desperately look back both to periods when a lot gets done to try to see what was better then. And we also look to figures who were, at the center of those moments to try to explain they must have known something. They must have been able to pull some strings. If we could only do that again, if we could only have a president who speaks, who schmoozes, who wheels and deals like a Lyndon Johnson, things will be better. You know, the answer that it was a unique moment, that it took this heavy lift to get a Congress that was going to pass things, it's a much bigger and more difficult thing to replicate than, well, if we elect the right person, we're all set.
You say, and what happens, I guess, after, 1966, the election of 1966, there are, you know, a number of Democrats sort of lose office and more Republicans come into Congress, that really then did change the dynamic in what Johnson was able to accomplish.
Oh, my God. It was really important. You know, no one likes to write about midterm elections. It's not something in most stories.
That's right.
But it became clear to me, as we know in current life, they're hugely important to politics. And those midterms, Republicans are trying to regain their strength, as are Southern conservatives. It's a campaign that focuses on the deficit and arguments that the deficit is skyrocketing and spending is too rampant under Johnson. Republicans and conservatives are saying Vietnam's a mess, not because we shouldn't be there, but because Johnson isn't willing to unleash all of America's power against the North Vietnamese. And finally, there's a racial backlash toward an open housing bill. Lyndon Johnson, for all his schmoozing, for all his treatment, after 1966, can't get what he wants at all. And so for me, it was a key moment where you start to challenge some of these arguments about what the right kind of presidential style can do.
Do you think Johnson lost the South for the Democrats because of some of these Great Society programs?
Eventually. He doesn't lose them right away. He loses some of the South in 1964. In 66, really what happens are a lot of the Democrats who had been elected in 64 in Republican areas in the Midwest, like Wisconsin and Michigan, they're defeated. They only last for 2 years. So it will take several generations for Johnson to lose the South, or for Democrats to lose the South. Eventually they will. Democrats will become Republican, and that's now the heart of the Republican Party. And part of it is the cost of policy victory. Johnson knew that great policy victory doesn't always bring political success. It can actually cost you.
How much do you think the Vietnam War was Johnson's undoing?
Huge. Certainly for many Democrats, it discredited him. But more importantly, during his presidency, it gave conservatives an opportunity to force his hand on spending. They said that if you want to spend on Vietnam, you're going to have to cut domestic spending. And that's exactly what would happen in 1968.
And liberals, it seems, I mean, if he had a liberal base, were also turning against the president because of Vietnam.
They were disillusioned with him, and they were more focused, many of them, on the war and its impact than they were on some domestic achievements, which had been pretty stunning.
What's so interesting, you write, Julian, that when Nixon becomes president, he does not dismantle these great society programs. And we're talking about a much bigger federal government that happened during the 1960s.
Absolutely. So part of this book is about how hard it is to get bills through and how short these windows are that we imagine can happen again, that they're just a very limited amount of time when liberalism has had chances to succeed. But the other part of the story is that when this happens, the programs often endure. And when Richard Nixon runs in 1968, he doesn't run a campaign where he really takes on most of the Great Society programs. He does attack poverty programs. He talks about law and order. But he doesn't go after many of the landmark bills and talk about them at all. Many people said his campaign was so vague, they really didn't know what he stood for. Hmm. And during his presidency, Democrats still control Congress, and a lot of the programs would continue to grow. Nixon would end up signing bills that expands the government into areas like the environment. And over the next few decades, almost every Great Society program just keeps growing. And to the point where today we don't really think of them as something that, you know, might go away. So, during the debate over Obama's Health Care Act, some protesters from the Tea Party were saying, take your government hands off my Medicare, saying that the program threatened Medicare. It was ironic, but it also made sense. Programs like Medicare and Medicaid became part of the fabric of American life. Food stamps, Head Start, education funding. All these programs survived both Nixon and what came after. Nixon certainly never felt that he could really undo the Great Society. And that, in some ways, was Johnson's greatest victory, that his successor left the programs alone.
That was my 2015 interview with presidential historian Julian Zelizer. He joined us to discuss his book, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. When we get back from the break, we'll continue our examination of LBJ by listening to my interview with Johnson biographer Robert Caro. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us today. We continue our look at President Lyndon Johnson by listening to an interview with biographer Robert Caro. Now, no one knows more about Johnson than Caro after writing a 4-volume series on the man, each one detailing a different period of his life. The 4th volume, called The Passage of Power, won the National Book Award and was named one of the best books of 2012. But we thought we'd listen to my interview from 2002, in which Caro detailed Johnson's time in the U.S. Senate and how he managed to become one of Congress's most effective dealmakers. Let's take a listen.
How did he see power, the power that he had? The reason I wanted to write about Lyndon Johnson in the first place, I was always interested in explaining political power, because that's what shapes all our lives. Now, Johnson, I wanted to write about because in the second half of the 20th century, he, more than anybody else, understood national power. The epigraph from this book is a quote, not for me, but for him. He says, "Whatever else they say about me, I do understand power. I know where to look for it, and I know how to use it." This book is really about how he looked for it in the Senate and then how he got it and used it.
Well, and he was an amazing observer, I guess, of human beings. I mean, he had also, the way you write about him, just enormous energy, but kind of could read his fellow members of the Senate in a way like nobody else.
Well, I call him a reader of men. You know, he never liked to read books. He never was much of a reader. But he could read men, and he used to tell his assistants, "Watch their eyes, watch their hands. What a man's telling you with his mouth is never as important as what he's telling you with his eyes." Or he would say, "You know, the most important thing a man has to tell you is what he's not telling you, what he's not saying." So he always would try to keep a conversation going until he found out what the other fellow didn't want to tell him.
This book also includes photographs of Lyndon Johnson at work on the phone, talking to people. And first of all, we should say that he was a pretty tall guy, 6'3"?
Just under 6'4", yeah.
Just under 6'4", so yes. And especially in the 1950s, a pretty tall guy.
Yes.
But you can see from the photographs the way he used his body and even the way he would touch someone as a way of manipulating them, of exerting his authority.
Yeah, he put one arm. His characteristic thing was he'd put one arm around your shoulder to keep you in place. And with the other hand, as he talked and got worked up, he'd jab your chest with his forefinger harder and harder. Or if you weren't coming around, he would grab your lapel with that hand, you know. And he really was a great persuader. They said he was the greatest salesman one-on-one who ever lived. The Senate is a very small body, you know. So when he gets there, the first time, it was fascinating, because Walter Jenkins, one of his assistants, was with him the first time he walked into the Senate chamber. It was out of session. Right. They were all alone. The chamber was very dim. Lyndon Johnson stands in the door, and Jenkins hears him say, under his voice, "Just the right size." You know, and Jenkins knows exactly what he means. If you can work on someone one-on-one, Lyndon Johnson is going to win.
And he was from the South. Certainly Texas was from the South. But
yes.
but a different kind of Southerner, I guess.
He was a different kind of Southerner, although in his first years in the Senate, to rise to power and needing these men who had all the power in the Senate, he was very much a Southerner. His first speech began, "We of the South."
So there was this great then division within the Senate between the North and the South. I mean, in a certain sense, the Civil War, and this was after World War II, of course, that the Civil War or the feelings from the Civil War were still very evident within the U.S. Senate.
Within the U.S. Senate, the South wasn't going to allow any changes in the plight, really, of black Americans. You know, as late as 1956, before Johnson passes his first civil rights bill, out of, I think, 6 million blacks of voting age, only about 600,000, 1 in 10, voted. There were whole counties throughout the South in which no black American had ever cast a vote.
And yet, as you say, his first speech talks about "We of the South." He blocked lots of legislation, civil rights legislation, but not this one, not the Civil Rights Act.
No, up till 1957, he had opposed every, even anti-lynching.
He had
bills.
Opposed anti-lynching.
Yes. Yeah, bills to make lynching a federal crime.
Yes.
Johnson opposed them. In 1957, he does this complete about-face and decides to pass the first civil rights bill since Reconstruction. It seems impossible. You say, this can't be, because the South has so much power in the Senate. To watch him do it, to maneuver this bill through, to ram it through with this really savage determination to pass it, is really the height of legislation. You know, you say, this is legislative genius. You know, in other countries, they have a parliamentary system. So let's say in England, you have 100 biographies of Gladstone and 100 biographies of Disraeli, and they examine legislative power. Here, when we talk about power, it's mostly presidential power. That's what we mean, executive power. This book is about legislative power.
And what he did was he would sort of sweet-talk the segregationists, the old bulls, and tell them one thing. And then he would turn around and talk to the NAACP and certain northern members of the Senate and tell them something else.
That was one of the things he did, yeah. But behind this always was this great power that he had to make, you know, over bills that senators needed. And that was always a threat. And Johnson, they knew he was really ruthless, and he would use this power.
Why did he want, though? I mean, after blocking so much civil rights legislation, why did he want this particular bill? And this became the Civil Rights Act of 1957.
I think it's perfect. It's really true that Lyndon Johnson always had this compassion in him, this desire to help poor people, and particularly poor people of color. I always felt it was true because I knew it was true because when he's still in college at the age of 20, he has to drop out for a year to earn money to stay in college, and he becomes a teacher at the Mexican-American school in a little town called Catula, which is south of San Antonio. And I wrote in the first volume that no teacher had ever cared if those kids learned or not.
He was very demanding as a teacher.
Yes, he was. He really cared. And he not only taught the kids, but to me was the clincher that he really meant it. He even taught the janitor. After school, he would sit on the steps of the school with the janitor, whose name was Tomas Coronado. And Coronado said, you know, Johnson would spell, I would repeat, I would pronounce, Johnson would repeat. He always wanted to do that. He also was terribly ambitious to become president. And not until the compassion and the ambition came together would he change. They came together in 1957. His chief advisor, the guy he trusted most, says to him, this is Armageddon. This is a memo. He actually writes Johnson. This is Armageddon for Lyndon Johnson. You can, and then he says, in effect, you can either pass a civil rights bill or forget about being president.
So it was this way of launching himself to the White House, but it also, as you say, reflects, I guess, a kind of personal relationship that he had with blacks and, I guess, Mexicans as well.
Well, yes. That he had a great empathy for them. Part of it was because he did the same kind of work, picking cotton, working on a road gang, that blacks and Mexican Americans did in the Texas Hill Country. So he understood their work, you know. And more than that, he had this ability to read people, to put himself in their place. It's sort of like an empathy. And he really did feel the indignities that were treated on people who had colored skin. He always wanted to help, but you can't overemphasize the other part. He wasn't going to do it unless it came in tune with what he wanted.
Because the other part of this portrait of this man is a man that also would speak in the most degrading terms, would call blacks boy and would insult people really to their face.
To their face, yes. And rub it in. Yeah.
I guess it's hard to come to sort of one conclusion about him. But I guess, as you say, it's this mix of opportunism, ambition, and this compassion.
Well, the amazing thing is that this man, who did so much for black Americans, believed in racial stereotypes. One that I started to say, he believed that blacks were afraid of snakes, so that he would put a snake in the trunk of his car, right inside the spare tire, which is where they carried this tire then. Then he'd drive to a gas station. If the attendant was black, he would say, would you take a look at my snake, to make the fellow afraid.
There's this one incident.
And, I mean, there was this one incident. He did it one time too many in Austin at a service station at Congress and First Avenue. And the black attendant picked up a jack tire iron, said, I'll make you a tire iron bow tie of this, and chased Johnson out of the station. And he was doing this. This isn't just when he was a young man. This incident occurred in 1946 and 1947 when Lyndon Johnson was a congressman of the United States. Yet when he decides to pass the first civil rights bill, no one could have been more effective in doing it.
So it wasn't exactly like he had an epiphany. It was just that he saw that for pragmatic reasons, that it was time to bring about civil rights legislation?
You know, one thing that I believe is that power always reveals. You know, we're taught that Lord Acton's axiom that all power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The more I write about power, the less sure I am is that that is true.
Hmm.
What I think is always true is that power reveals, because now you have it, you can do what you want with it. In Johnson's case, when he gets the power, he can do something he always wanted to do, which was to help poor people.
You think it's, I mean, it really comes down
I
to
think
that.
I think that that is just as, I said he had a compassion which is true and real and deep. He had an ambition which is true and real and deeper. But when they come together in 1957, he's finally freed to let that compassion be embodied in laws.
Because up until that time, as you say, he had blocked so much of civil rights legislation.
Yes, he had really been a member of the Southern Bloc.
Right. As I was reading your book, I was wondering about houses of black Americans, certainly back in the 60s and even into the 70s, probably to today, the pictures that they had in their house. And it was Martin Luther King Jr. and it was Bob Kennedy and Ted Kennedy, not Lyndon Johnson. Bob Kennedy actually and John Kennedy, but not Lyndon Johnson, a man that you say has done more for blacks in this country than anyone since Lincoln.
You know, that's an amazing thing. I'm glad you brought that up because it's absolutely right. The pictures are mainly of Martin Luther King and President Kennedy. Yet it's Lyndon Johnson. See, I think I wrote Abraham Lincoln struck the shackles off black Americans, but it was Lyndon Johnson who, with his voting rights legislation, took their hand, led them into the voting booths, and put that hand on the lever that gave them at last control over their own political destiny. Yet his role in doing this has sort of been lost. I mean, if there's one thing you really want people to take out of this book, Master of the Senate, it's that if he hadn't passed the civil rights legislation, what would have happened? Because no one else was able to do it.
And you also say that his argument to the South was that we got to show them we're not a bunch of barefoot tobacco chewing crazies, that it's time to sort of bring a new image to the South.
Yes, that was one of the arguments he'd use. He would use, you know, Johnson would use any argument he had to. He'd change him from one person to another. You see him in the cloakroom, you know, he'd walk over to the liberal Paul Douglas and he'd say, "Paul, we're going to bring up that civil rights bill." Then he'd walk across the room to a bunch of Southerners and say, "That goddamn nigger bill is coming up again."
Mm. And did he believe himself when he was talking to these two very different camps of people? Did he believe what he was saying?
That's a very good question. Johnson seemed to be able to make himself believe whatever he needed to believe in that instant.
Really?
And then 5 minutes later, he could be believing talking. He could work himself up to these different beliefs.
And kind of convince himself into each of his arguments.
Yes, he could.
Whoever it was.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you say, and this is about, I guess, the Civil Rights Act of 1957, is that it was a more watered-down bill, I would assume, that compared to its original form.
The bill that he passed in 1957, Marty, was so watered down that it was almost meaningless.
Right.
But the fact that it passed wasn't meaningless at all. That was the all-important thing, because Johnson understood, you know, he had a very crude mouth. And what he said to the liberals is, it doesn't matter what's in this bill. Once we break the virginity, it'll be easier next time. The liberals in the Senate, the Senate as a whole, believed in 1957 that you could not beat the South. The South had simply beaten them too many times.
Mm.
So they were afraid of the South. The Southerners were chairman of almost all the major committees. And, you know, and the committees had the power in the Senate. So any civil rights person or liberal who wanted to fight the South had to be aware that his bills could be held up. They could not be, money could not be appropriated. They used to say, "What will they do to me? If I fight for civil rights, what will they do to me in appropriation?" Johnson said, if we can prove we can beat the South once, people's thinking will change. We'll be able to do it again. And he was right. This bill, as you so correctly say, had been watered down almost to a point of meaninglessness, but the fact that it passed was the most meaningful thing in the world.
But he was the consummate deal maker, right? I mean, this is why it worked so well in the Senate, is that he could craft these compromises.
Yes, he could. You know, there's one, if I can tell you one example of this, which
ahead.
Is striking to me. He has to persuade the South to let this 1957 civil rights bill go forward without filibustering. He promises them that he'll water it down. But they're not going to let it go forward unless they know that if it's not watered down, they can filibuster and the Senate will not be able to impose cloture. Now, to keep them from imposing cloture, they need 33 votes, one-third of the Senate then, right? So what they have to have there are 22 Southern votes in the Senate from the 11 Southern states. Johnson has to bring them about another 11 or 12 votes. Individual compromises aren't going to work here. He needs a block. And he has this stroke, not just of legislative power, but of legislative genius. There's this canyon in the West called Hell's Canyon between Idaho and Oregon. And the Western senators want a federal dam there. Now, the conservatives, the Republican conservatives, but also the South, have always said no private money can build that. They're opposed to government expansion. So the South always opposed it. Johnson persuades the South to give the West enough votes to approve this dam. If in return the West will say, not that they will be opposed to civil rights, but that they will vote to uphold the filibuster and the bill. I mean, that's a stroke of genius.
Absolutely. To be able to sort of play all these factions and to sort of be three steps ahead of them.
Marty, to say, I'm going to bring the West to the side of the South. Mm-hmm. Now, that's something working on a national scale. No one had ever thought of a connection between the Hell's Canyon Dam and civil rights. Johnson saw it. And as a result of that, the bill moved another step forward.
Did members of the Senate fear him more than anything else?
They did fear him. You know, it's Scoop Jackson was once comparing Lyndon Johnson to Jack Kennedy as president. He said the difference is that if Kennedy needed a senator's vote, he'd call him down, he'd tell him all the reasons he needed it. But if at the end the senator said to him, you know, my constituency, they won't allow this. Kennedy would always say, this is Scoop Jackson's words, sure, I understand. Then Scoop Jackson said, the thing about Lyndon Johnson is he wouldn't understand. He would threaten you or knock your block off or bribe you or cajole you, anything to get your vote. But the thing was, he would get that vote. Johnson was a very ruthless politician.
Ends justify the means.
I would say a little differently than that. I would say the life of Lyndon Johnson raises all the questions about ends and means that we've had. It's all summed up in his career.
That was my 2002 interview with Lyndon Johnson biographer Robert Caro. We played that interview because of the upcoming HBO series about Johnson called All the Way, starring Bryan Cranston. Coming up, some insights into the LGBT movement from journalist and radio talk show host Michelangelo Signorelli. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. North Carolina's controversial House Bill 2 gained national attention for its strict policy on transgender bathroom use. But it also includes several sections which make explicit that sexuality is not protected under the state's non-discrimination law and that private companies have the right to set their own policies on the matter. Now, activists see this as an attack on LGBT rights and protections that have increased in recent years. The federal government has sued North Carolina. We talked about the recent LGBT victories with journalist and SiriusXM talk show host Michelangelo Signorelli. He's editor-at-large for the Huffington Post Gay Voices section, and he joined us last year when his book, It's Not Over, was published. Let's take a listen. What is victory blindness?
It's something that I began to note, a phenomenon I began to note as I saw a lot of the celebrations of victory over the last few years and saw that both LGBT leaders, some in the community, as well as the media were looking at these achievements and then beginning to use the word inevitable about full equality. Of course, marriage is something very important, but as you just pointed out about Pennsylvania, 29 states, no protections with discrimination as in housing, or public accommodations, be thrown out of a restaurant, a shop, no federal laws, and that's just the beginning. There's the culturally embedded homophobia and transphobia. So I started to see that idea, that inevitable word, and that leads to the apathy, but it also leads to a different tactic we start to see, where people start saying, we should be magnanimous and gracious in our wins and be less confrontational because, you know, now these poor people who persecuted us all this while, they're the losers now.
Or that, maybe they even like us.
Yes. And I just think that's a trap because it allows the backlash to begin. And I think we've seen that with other groups. So I'm saying let's learn from other groups.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what, I guess, what has changed. And how much do you think just people coming out has changed just how other people see gays and lesbians, and how much you think there is growing support for equality?
There's no question that we've seen dizzying change in the past few years. And coming out is enormously important. Every study that's done shows that people who know people who are gay are more likely to support gay rights. Certainly people coming out in their own families have changed their own families, their parents or others in their families. So that has been certainly a catalyst for a lot of this change. And I think that we need to continue that.
Making it a safe, I mean, the more people that are out, the safer it is to then to come out.
The more people out, the more others feel comfortable, and particularly when people in public life are out, the more the society in general feels like, well, there are a lot of gay people, and it's my next door neighbor, but it's also this television star that I really like, and it's this one, and it's that one, it's my cousin, and it's my daughter, and they really do start to change their minds.
This goes back a couple of decades, but you were very active in outing a number of people, including Malcolm Forbes, Pete Williams, and there was some pushback, some backlash that you got. You outed Malcolm Forbes actually after he had died.
Right. The entire issue, I think, especially at the time, was so distorted by much of the media. It was Time magazine that came up with this word, outing. I was simply putting out there in the middle of the most horrific epidemic we had experienced in this country and certainly the gay community after finally finding its voice.
This is AIDS, of course.
Seeing ourselves being decimated, yes, and seeing such an intolerance and indifference, intolerance by a right-wing government, indifference by the media and others, and seeing people dying. And it was urgent that people be out. And it was urgent that we, as we just discussed, show the public that very prominent people are gay. And so I began to write about that in my column in Outweek. And I really was critiquing the media and saying, you should be reporting on it when it is relevant to a larger story. I had been a publicist before that, and we used to actually heterosexualize the gay and lesbian actors. We would have to tell the truth about everything else to the gossip columnists and whatnot, but we'd match up the gay actors with straight someone of the opposite gender and sort of heterosexualize them. So I started to say, look, we need to have this equalization in the media. That was caught. I mean, when Malcolm Forbes died, I said, well, you know, they're all going to report for history that this man who was a right wing icon of the, you know, economic right wing principles was Elizabeth Taylor's boyfriend. I need to write the story. It was Time magazine that decided, and I would later find out it was a closeted bisexual man. His wife wrote me, William Henry III, who coined the term, and it's a violent active verb. I just saw it as reporting.
Well, and we could do a whole hour on this. Yeah. And actually, 25 years ago, we probably did two whole hours on this. But I guess there's one thing to sort of out yourself, and it's another thing for someone to out somebody else, especially when it involves their private life. And if they're not hurting somebody and just living their private life, can't they be left alone?
Well, I think when it comes to people of enormous privilege and the glass closet, which is very different than someone who is deeply closeted and, you know, is married to somebody of the opposite gender, not bisexual and sort of having sex on the side or whatever. This glass closet are people who are known to be gay. Everybody around them knows they're gay. They socialize in the gay community. Everybody in the media knows they're gay, but nobody talks about it. And I think with those people, why not? What's wrong with being gay? Rosie O'Donnell and I did a town hall at SiriusXM a couple of weeks ago where she interviewed me, and I was honored to do it on the book. But we have quite a history because I was pressuring her. And she said to me, you know, you did the right thing, because between Ellen DeGeneres coming out and you pressuring me, you both influenced me. It was one was an inspirational story one way. One was a guy who was a pain in the neck. But one way or another, it needed to be done. I needed to come out. And that pressure was good. And
but it was her decision.
Right. It was her decision in the end. But there were those of us who were pushing her and saying, come on, Rosie. Everybody knows you talk about it. But you talk about this. You're out with this one. You're out with that one. I mean, we used to see the media photographing Jodie Foster with her children, and there'd be this woman in the background, and they'd never say who the woman was. But if that was a man, they would tell you who that was. And you better believe if it was somebody she was sleeping with, they would tell you every detail about it. That, to me, is a media double standard.
What was it like for you to come out?
It was, you know, that process that you come to terms with it from a very young age. I was 8 years old when I realized that I was gay, and through my teen years, I was sexually active, but also tormented about the whole idea and wanting to be straight and wanting to do whatever I could. Certainly had the suicidal thoughts.
Did you really?
Absolutely. And it wasn't until I went to college and really sort of got away from home that I became more comfortable. But it wasn't really until I got involved with ACT UP and really sort of saw this from the political perspective of what it does that I really came out to everyone in my life in a big way and realized how important it was.
Let's talk a little bit about what's been happening in a number of states, these RFRA, as they're known, these RFRA laws. And here we are talking about people making cakes for weddings.
Right.
And how do you reconcile this?
Well, these are the laboratories where anti-gay forces sort of put together the ways they're going to blunt gay rights. And they had been talking for a while. What happens if the Supreme Court does rule in favor of marriage equality? Well, they don't use that term. But, you know, same-sex marriage or not traditional marriage. And they talked about the various things they would need to do. And religious liberties bills and conscience clauses. I think we're going to see this term quite a bit, too. And we've seen it with the reproductive rights movement. You know, the pharmacist who shouldn't have to serve a woman contraception or the morning after pill, right? So they were talking about those things. And they were talking about how, you know, we in the LGBT movement, I think too many in the media, look at the larger picture and see them as, oh, they did something and they lost and that's that. They see it as, oh, we had a trial balloon. It didn't work. Let's go back to the laboratory. So Arizona, they tried to pass one of these bills. Governor Jan Brewer vetoed it. We all thought, aha, we won. They said, no, let's go back and retool it. Mm-hmm. And so they went back, retooled, and obviously Indiana and Arkansas was another shot at it. This with Bobby Jindal, he's trying to make it specifically about wedding cakes and specifically about marriage in particular so that he can get away from Governor Pence's dilemma of any business. And, you know, a recent poll the AP did showed that 57% of people, even many who support marriage equality, mm-hmm. believe a baker should be able to not serve a cake to a gay couple. So there's the education we need to do, and they're finding that wedge.
And what's the answer back to that person who says the baker has a right not to make a cake for a gay wedding?
The answer is you're a public business and you are open to the public. If you were just working in a church and baking for Christians in the church, that's one thing. But if you're open to the public, you have to serve everybody. Nobody is infringing your speech. There's nothing. None of these cases, by the way, have ever been about what gets written on the cake. They don't even get to the point of the cake being baked. I think you would have the right not to put, and there have been some challenges by Christians to put on the cake, you know, something like, I'm opposed to marriage equality, and bakers have said no, but that's a speech issue. This is simply about serving people.
And about public comment. I mean,
right.
It is, because it's about a business.
Open to the public.
To the public.
And once you open that door to not allowing based on one thing, well, then it'll be on another thing and another thing and another thing. And then it'll be beyond bakers. It'll be a restaurant that says, well, I don't like these two people coming in. They were holding hands. And I don't like that. So I don't want to serve those people.
You go to CPAC. You go to the Values Forum. I mean, I think for some people, they just think, I'm going to stay away from these people. But you go, why? Because you want to learn. You want to talk.
I think it is important to engage with the people and study the people who are opposing my rights and trying to take away my rights, and bring that to my listeners who are really concerned about that. Certainly, I think it also helps a lot of people when they hear me debating with these people to debate with their own family about these issues. So I do like to go and engage and to also see how they're organizing, because often a lot of the media reporting from these events, they get on a certain narrative that sort of omits a lot of what's happening in the dark corners of these events.
But, I mean, can you, from your experience and from your conversation, say that these are people who truly believe what they say, you know, are well-intentioned, don't want you any harm? They just happen to believe what they believe?
I think most of the people are true believers, and they believe that their religious freedoms are under attack, and that the gay movement is somehow part of that. They also very much, are pro life and anti-abortion. They sort of, on many issues, they are very much, Christian evangelical based. And they, in that sense, are genuine in their beliefs. They're often misinformed, uninformed about issues, don't understand. I mean, at one event, they were talking about how we need to get protections for Christians. And I said, well, you do have protections. It's in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, protection based on religion. There's sort of this victimology that goes on. There's that group, and then there's the leaders. And the leaders know what the deal is, and particularly those in the Republican Party, but even the ones who run the major groups themselves know that they're often exploiting people who are misinformed and who are filled up with fear.
Well, it's interesting to think about the kind of activism that you have been involved in, and to think about legislation. And, of course, the courts as well have played such a big role. The U.S. Supreme Court is going to take up this issue of these bans on same-sex marriages across the country. Do you have any read or feel on how they're going to rule on that?
It's been pretty extraordinary to see what's gone on with the marriage movement, and to see the speed with which it sort of picked up just in the last year. And it's clear that the court, by allowing these lower court rulings to stand and allowing so many more people to get married, is intent on ruling in favor of marriage equality. At least that's – I talk to lawyers all day long, and that's what they say all the time on my program. The question is, with what legal theory they'll do it and how narrow it will be, and will it be a 5-4, or will they try to bring in John Roberts? Of course, Justice Kennedy has been the linchpin, but will they try to bring in John Roberts, and will that narrow it so that it is based on the lowest standard and will be difficult for it to apply to all these other things like Baker's and everything else? Because if it's not heightened scrutiny, then it's not at the same level as race. Then we are going to be at the court many times over many issues.
You say in this book that when New York legalized same-sex marriage, I guess that was 2011, that was the highest year for the number of gay murders. I mean, in a sense, making a connection between these two. Do you think that's cause and effect?
It was also the highest year. This is another extraordinary figure. A 40% increase in 2011 when New York passed marriage equality in homeless youth in New York City. A 40% jump. And a lot of people believe that, youth advocates believe, kids saw, oh, wow, there's gay marriage. I'm going to come out of the closet now. And yet they had parents who were not accepting. And it's an extraordinary thing to think. And homeless youth, 40% of them are LGBT. So that gives you, nationwide, it gives you another window into this. But yes, there has been a backlash to the visibility. There always is a backlash to the visibility. And again, this victory blindness, people don't look at that. And it often hurts the most marginalized parts of our community, people who don't have resources, gay people of color, transgender people, transgender women of color have been murdered by a rate of 3-1 compared to other gay, lesbian, bisexual people. So it all gets kind of covered up in a sense when we're on this victory blindness, the victory narrative.
That was my 2015 interview with journalist Michelangelo Signorelli, author of It's Not Over.
And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Artie Moscow-Aim. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.